Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen. Jim Hightower does not mince words. At a time when most of the press seems hesitant to challenge the official version of anything, Jim Hightower just up and says they're lying. In his words, the United States has become a kleptocrat nation, that is, a body of people ruled by thieves. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with Jim Hightower about his latest book, Thieves in High Places. They've stolen our country, and it's time to take it back. And we'll also talk about a number of issues, including one of his latest projects, the Rolling Thunder Downhome Democracy Tour, which he describes as a series of progressive citizenship festivals in various cities across the country, combining serious purpose with good fun. Many of you already know about Jim Hightower. He was twice elected to the Office of Agriculture Commissioner in Texas and is often called America's most popular populist. His daily radio commentaries are carried on more than 100 stations, in addition to Armed Forces Radio and the Sirius satellite radio system. His monthly newsletter, the Hightower Lowdown, has more than 100,000 subscribers and has won both the Alternative Press Award and the Independent Press Association Award for Best National Newsletter. Several of Jim Hightower's books have been bestsellers, including If the Gods Had Meant Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates, and he gives about 100 speeches each year in addition to frequent radio and television appearances. Jim Hightower's latest book, again, is entitled Thieves in High Places, recently published by Viking, and we'll talk about that during this hour. As we talk with Jim Hightower, we invite you into the conversation. That's what this show is all about. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, or if you're listening on the web anywhere in the continental United States. Our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We also have an email address if you'd like to join us by email, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu. And Jim Hightower, very busy man, joins us by telephone this morning. Mr. Hightower, hello.
Hey, great to be with you, Jack, and all the Focus 580 people out there.
Well, we're very glad to have you with us. Just to start, you've been accused of having a sense of humor.
But dangerous thing in politics these days.
But from reading your book, I take it that you use words like kleptocracy quite seriously.
Well, indeed, because this is what has happened to our nation, that our democracy has essentially been usurped by corporate kleptocrats and by their puppets in Washington of both political parties. In my book, I've got a chapter called Bush Co., the first fully corporatized White House in our lifetime, but I also have a chapter called Wobblycrats, my party, the Democrats in Washington, that have jello'd on us, refusing to stand up against this kleptocracy. And by corporate kleptocrats, by kleptocracy, I'm referring to the decision-making power in our country that has been removed from our families and our neighborhoods and communities and lifted into the executive suites. Just about everything, Jack, that we deal with these days, from what's in the food that we put on our family table to what's in our evening news feed, from who gets a job at what wage to who goes to Congress, these decisions that have in the past been much more of a people's decision, a public decision, now increasingly are within the fiefdoms of these private for-profit enterprises.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly money and politics have long been bedfellows, and I think that, you know, there's a long tradition of cynicism in America with regard to the entanglement of you know, big money in politics. Do you think that in the past decade or so it's gotten that much worse?
Oh, indeed it has. And the thievery has gotten worse. I mean, you know, anybody can ask themselves the question, you know, if I call my Congress critter and I'm just, you know, Joe Schmo or Jill Frill, you know, regular citizen, am I even going to get a phone call return, much less from the Congress critter? But, you know, if I am a $10,000, $100,000, $1 million donor to the politician and the political parties, then yes, I'm going to get my call returned. It's a world in which money has supplanted our people's democratic control, and that has gotten aggressively worse in the last decade. And now I believe to the point that money essentially rules.
Mm-hmm. One of the big mantras of government in the last few years, certainly the last decade or so, has been to run government like a business.
Mm-hmm. That's a great. I mean, I have to burst out laughing at that. I mean, are they thinking of Enron or WorldCom or maybe one of the mutual funds that are in the news today? What business exactly are they thinking of? But you're right, and again, both political parties have used this line, Bush and Cheney, particularly in the last election, just stressed this, that they were both corporate executives and that they would run our federal government like a business. Well, corporate executivehood is not a very proper training ground for leaders of our public interests. Corporations, after all, are by their very nature hierarchical, secretive, autocratic organizations in which the sole purpose is for everybody to do what the CEO says in order to advance the bottom line of the biggest investors, which invariably include the CEOs themselves. So it has a corporation has a very narrow purpose. It's anti-democratic, has no tolerance for democratic processes, and so that's quite the opposite of the kind of leadership that you need that would encompass the larger goals of the public and encompass the much broader interests of we the people.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller already, and I promise I'll get right to them, but I wanted to just follow up on that with one more question, then we'll get to the phones. There's been a lot of criticism of the current administration in the way that it has awarded contracts, for example, in Iraq to rebuild the infrastructure of that country and to get the oil industry going and so forth. And I think a lot of the focus has been because, of course, the vice president was the head of Hal Burton and some of the other corporate involvements of present and former White House officials in the corporations that have been awarded these contracts. And, I guess, the White House has said in response to that, well, we're not hiding this. This is out in the open, and that people shouldn't be concerned because we are, we're doing this so publicly. That
well, yeah, it's a wide open, galloping corporate cronyism is what it is, and it's not only injurious to our country, but it's also an insult. They feel that they don't have to even hide it. The people be damned. We are rewarding our campaign contributors and also rewarding corporations that we've been involved in. After all, Halliburton continues to put about $150,000 a year into Cheney's personal pocket, so he personally profits from this. And, this is, Halliburton's like a bad tamale. It just keeps repeating on us. It's Brown & Root subsidiary. Those of you who are old enough will remember during the Vietnam period that it was making contributions to the Democratic President Lyndon Johnson at the time and reaping billions of dollars in war profiteering funds, and now it's doing the exact same thing. So this is not a new phenomenon by any means, but it has been accelerated, expanded, and then, just as you indicate, has become much more blatant. Hey, yeah, we're doing it, and the hell with y'all. We're going to keep doing it.
Well, our lines are basically full. I want to get on and include some listeners. So I have other questions, but I'll defer to them. We'll go first to someone in Decatur on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, this is glad to have a chance to talk to Jim Hightower. I enjoy your column in the Progressive Populist every couple of weeks.
Thank you, sir.
I want to explore an idea that on why is money so? Why has money corrupted politics to the extent it has? Now, other I think it may go beyond the simple kleptocracy that is maybe, the U.S. and Russia like to compete on many fields, and we're coming close in this one. But I've come to blame it on, so much of the money in the campaigns goes to television.
Mm-hmm.
So I blame it on the voters who refuse, who get all, have decided they can make all their decisions by watching television. And I'm just, this puts me in total despair, because what's the cure for this?
Yeah. Well, I believe that the, you're right, the power of television has become destructive to our democracy in large part because it depersonalizes our democratic process and puts power in the hands of a conglomerate few. But I, in my view, what's really gone wrong here is we do not have a party of opposition. Back in about 1980, Tony Coelho, then a member of Congress from out in California, was chair of the Democratic Congressional Fundraising Arm. And Coelho decided, hey, we can get some of that same corporate money that the Republicans are getting. And he put our party on a path away from our populist principles and constituency, because if you're taking those corporate checks, and I come to you as, you know, one who is no virgin, I've been elected here in the state of Texas to statewide office, and I've seen this money power up close and personal. When you take those corporate checks, written on the back of them is the corporate agenda. And so we don't have a party that is free and unabashedly supporting the democratic interests, the worker interests, the family farmer interests, the ordinary workaday stiff's interest in government anymore. Rather, we have both parties at one degree or another, the Republicans more so, but I'm sad to say the Democrats as well. You know, my party has taken off its Sears Roebuck work boots and strapped on the same Gucci's and Pucci's that the Republicans are strutting around in. And that leaves the majority of people unrepresented, and it leaves our political process with no force that is consistently and intently attempting to get the money out of the process, since everybody in the game is profiting from the status quo.
Right. I agree with you 100%. My own position has come to, I do participate in politics on the local and county level.
Yes.
But I do no longer participate on the state or federal level. I don't trust any of them. And when I vote in those elections in order to get my none of the above counted, I vote for some hopeless third party, which everybody tells me is a waste, but I think it's a way of being counted.
I do too. And I'm very pleased that you raised this, because the answer is not, as Jack was saying earlier, that you get a lot of cynicism as a result of this money control of our process. Well, getting cynical is not going to fix anything. We've got to get more involved where we can make a difference. And that is, just as you're suggesting, at the very least, don't let them drive you out of the voting booth. Go in there and vote for your dog or vote for somebody. You know,
they don't count write-ins unless they've registered 30 years.
I understand that they fix the rules, but at least, you know, do what you're doing. And more importantly, I think the other positive thing that you offered that is so strong, and that is get involved locally. If we're going to build a progressive political movement that literally can take power back from these kleptocrats, then that's got to be built at the grassroots level. It doesn't start by running for president.
Right.
And those of us who are progressive have been spending too much time, I think, worrying about who's going to be the presidential candidate. Yes, it's important, in my view, to get rid of Bush because they're so dangerous, but that's not a progressive victory, even if we do. Rather, we've got to be focusing on who's going to be state rep, who's going to be city council member, county commissioner, and then up to Congress and then to Senate. And then if we build a movement there, electing people who can make a difference and change the way the political process and government operates, then in another 8 years or 12 years, we'll be in a position to elect a true progressive, unattached to the money interest, to the presidency.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for the call. We have several people waiting. We'll go next to someone on a car phone on line number one. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Hi there.
Yeah.
I feel a kindred spirit here. I'm a native Texan who's a Democrat. I feel like a dying breed. But one thing that kind of gets me with the Bush administration, and I have oilmen and farmers in my family tree, so a horse thief would probably improve my family standing. But the thing that gets me, especially with the education initiatives, like if the school doesn't meet up to stuff, they're going to cut its funding and stuff like this, is, and the latest corporate greed, especially with Halliburton, to mention one. And I'd like your comments on this, Mr. Hightower, about they don't seem to take the long view. It all seems to be short-term, run it now, and move out.
Well, indeed, and that is another example of why corporate executives do not make good public office holders, is that the corporate mandate is not to take even a short-term view, but to be concerned about what the next quarter's results are going to look like. And then, even if the results are not going to be positive enough to satisfy the Wall Street big investment houses, then to fudge those numbers, as we've seen by Arthur Andersen and Enron and all the rest of them. So that short-term view, literally looking 3 months at a time, or at most a year, or in case of a presidency, a four-year term, rather than considering what is the long-term impact of all of this. And that's everything from, you know, ramming up this huge debt that is now amassed upon us in 2 short years. This administration, with the complicity of the Congress, I've got to say, has turned a $5 trillion surplus into a $5 trillion debt with more to come. The long-term ramification of this occupation in Iraq, of what this is doing that's going to endanger us and our children way down the road, because we're the exact wrong country with military might and corporate presence, logos like Halliburton, to be in that Muslim nation. Long-term impacts on the environmental changes that they are wreaking to allow their wealthiest contributors to take shortcuts on our clean air, clean water, clean food. Long-term impact of basically eliminating the family farm in America. Just an inexcusable action by so-called leaders not to understand the importance of agriculture and manufacturing, sending both off to third world nations. Long-term impacts just out the kazoo here that they don't think that they need to worry about, because they've got these spin doctors that can say, oh, well, this is good for us in the short run, and don't anybody notice, you know, the man behind the Oz machine.
How do we get back? You know, this is the one thing that really gets me about this, is that I go back to stuff that your grandmother taught you, especially like with the dot-com boom. It's like, you know, hey, don't catch your chickens while they're, before they're hatched.
Yeah.
Don't put your eggs in one basket. Save for a rainy day. It seems like all these values, I mean, in the 50s and 60s, we made massive infrastructure improvements. We built the interstate highway system. We built a ton of public schools. We got everything in place. And right now, that infrastructure that we put in 30, 40 years ago is just literally rotting in front of us. I mean, when I talk about increasing funding for education, I say, well, taxes will go up. I said, yeah, you got to pay for it.
Exactly.
You got to meet your responsibilities, folks.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like keeping up a house, you know.
Yeah, and the schools is all the lead paying the asbestos in my grants.
And you're right also about education, that, you know, if we are teaching the test instead of teaching cognitive abilities of citizens, then we're going to reap what we sow there, which is going to be ignorance. And this is a great failure. This is a great shame on our country, I think. A nation of such wealth and possibility being frittered away for a few to be able to make a killing. That's some kind of a country, but that's not America. You ask how we're going to change that? Well, we can't wait on somebody to do it for us. We've got to do that heavy lifting of democracy ourselves, and that means creating a new politics that actually talks about these issues. I believe that most folks care a hell of a lot about what's going on. I saw, Jack, a bumper sticker here in Austin, Texas, my town, about a year ago, that was on an old pickup truck. It said, "Where are we going, and what am I doing in this handbasket?"
Right.
I think most people have some awareness, some sense that we're being something terribly wrong is happening in our country, that we're being led down some rabbit path rather than a true American pursuit of an egalitarian society based on our values of fairness, justice, opportunity for all people. And I believe if we had a politics, a political party or numbers of political candidates who were willing to stand on those values and on those populist principles again, that there would be a tremendous rallying to that banner. And that's what we have to have if we're going to turn the country around.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Hightower, I think the last caller may be a representative of that that class of folks that you refer to as the politically homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, as the parties gear up for the coming election next year, they're going to be aiming at, you know, particular kinds of voters, the crossover voters, the swing voters, the particular people that they identify as key in particular districts that are going to help them win the delegates and the ultimate race. And I wonder, like, you know, what about all these other people who you call the politically homeless? If they actually got involved, you know, would the calculation involved in winning an election change?
Oh, of course. What we have now is politics by consultant. Republicans have theirs. Democrats have theirs. They all are very happy just to have the existing minority of people voting because they've got the list. They know how they vote. They know where they are. They know essentially what it is, what it takes to turn them out. And then they then temper the election to about 1 million voters in all of America who are considered the swing votes, the people that those soccer moms and office park dads who are sort of upper middle class but not quite sure where they stand on things and go this way or that way. Well, that's minimalist politics, and it shortchanges the American people and our great country's potential because it means that you gear your message to be non-offensive and to be as middle of the road as you can possibly get it. When in fact, most people are looking, as our previous caller was, for something that's got some boldness to it and that enlists the people of this country in the great cause of establishing that egalitarian possibility and maximizing what we can be as a people and as a nation. And I write about it in the book in terms of the last congressional election. And you might recall that Bush claimed a mandate out of that congressional election, and the media essentially awarded him a mandate, saying, "Oh yes, true, he didn't win in 2000, but by golly, now he won both houses of the Congress, so he's got a mandate." What they didn't tell us is that only 33% of the American people voted in those congressional elections in 2002. That means Bush is the actual choice of 17% of the people. Not exactly a political juggernaut and a very narrow slice of who we are as a people. Yet even sadder is that the Democrats could only get 15% to vote for them. Yet I hear the Democratic Leadership Council, which is the corporate wing of my party, saying, well, the answer is we've got to get more moderate, and we have to can't have anybody like Howard Dean, for example, or anybody who actually stands for anything, because that'll scare the people. And if we get more moderate and just get more of that corporate money, we can put these ads on television, and we could wean off some of that percent or two from Bush, and then we would win. Well, hello, here's 67% of the American people sitting out here, as you indicate, politically homeless, looking for somebody to say things that would appeal to them, like good jobs at good wages, renegotiating NAFTA and the WTO to include the people, not just corporations, education for everybody from kindergarten all the way through higher education, just like the GI Bill did in this country. Universal health care for everyone when they need it, not based on whether you've got you're able to pay. pay exorbitant insurance premiums or not. These kinds of issues that would actually tap into that 67% homeless majority.
Our lines are all full. We're already a little past our midpoint. Let me just reintroduce our guest during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Jim Hightower. He's the former commissioner of agriculture in Texas. He has had a talk show nationally, a syndicated around the country. His column is published in hundreds of papers around the country, and I'm sure you've seen his books. His latest is Thieves in High Places, recently published by Viking Press. And our lines are full, so let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning.
Good morning. I really appreciate your newsletter.
Thank you.
Although it's sometimes very disturbing. The last one in particular was really upsetting, where you talked about the voting machines.
Right.
And I wonder if you could just briefly, I don't want to steer you off on a different track, but if you could just address that briefly so the listeners can know something about it.
Well, I can indeed, and I appreciate it because it is a very, very important issue. Bad enough that they are that the money is driving people away from the polls. Worse is that those who go to the polls cannot necessarily be sure that their votes are actually getting counted the way they meant them to be counted. This is because our nation has now surged rapidly toward electronic touchscreen voting machines. The question being posed by the critics of these machines is after you've done your voting and then this little thing appears on the screen that says, here are the candidates you voted for, correct? And then you hit the little button on the screen that says, correct. Well, where does that go? and there is evidence that indeed these machines can be cracked into by your typical 13-year-old hacker. And votes diverted, or the machines shut down entirely without the election officials even knowing that it has stopped counting. That you can hack into the machine during the day that voting is taking place and get an early reading, and therefore redirect your resources or disable the machine. And there is evidence that this indeed has been going on around the country. And in my last issue, the Hightower Lowdown, I go into this. This is a huge subject that has received just relatively little attention from the mass media, and it is even more disconcerting to learn that the owners of these voting machine companies are not we the people. We don't own the machines. We lease them from these companies, and the owners are rabidly Republican partisans. Wally O'Dell from nearby Illinois there in Ohio. Wally O'Dell owns Diebold.
Mm-hmm.
He's CEO of that. Diebold provides machines for 40% of the vote count in America today. Well, he was a guest of George W.'s down at the Crawford Ranchette back in August when the Bush fundraisers all gathered, the big money raisers, they're called the Rangers and the Pioneers, to collect up hundreds of thousands of dollars each for Bush. Wally got so excited, he went back to Ohio, sent out a letter to his wealthy friends and asked for $10,000 each in contributions to the Bush reelection effort, and allowed us how he was committed to delivering Ohio's electoral votes to George W. in the next election. Then the next day, the Republican Secretary of State certified his company to be the provider of voting machines for the state of Ohio. Well, even the New York Times has to call this a perceived conflict of interest. And of course, this is most alarming. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican doesn't matter. You should not be able to steal elections, and particularly steal whole elections. You don't have to go steal the ballot box as used to happen maybe in Chicago or somewhere in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
Now with a click of the mouse, you can steal elections. So. What we need, the good news on this, is that it is fixable. And there's a piece of legislation, H.R. 2239, that requires a voter-verifiable paper trail of every vote that is cast. So when you click that little button saying, yes, that's how I voted, then you get a printout, just like you do from your ATM machine, that says, here's a piece of paper, this is how you voted. and then you turn that over to the election officials. So if there is a charge of fraud, if there's a recount needed, we actually have the paper ballots on hand to do that counting.
We should probably mention a couple of web addresses. You mentioned the Hightower Lowdown. The URL for that, if people would like to know more, would be jimhightowerlowdown.org, I believe. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And also your other main website is jimhightower.com. So those are good websites to look at if you want more information. We have a bunch of people waiting to talk. Let's go next to someone in Champaign County on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Yeah, so many things. Since you mentioned universal health care, I'd mention that Illinois actually has the opportunity. It passed the House already. There's something called the Health Justice Act that would set the state of Illinois on towards a universal health care. It's a 5 or 6 year program to do it, or maybe 4 year with a lot of town meetings and all that sort of stuff. A real democratic concept, but it's not getting a whole lot of press. But it's up for passage in the Senate in the two veto sessions we're having in the month of November.
Mm-hmm. This is very important because states are taking the lead in this. Maine has already passed something like you're talking about, and of course your governor is pushing for prescription drug purchases from Canada to a nation that does not allow price gouging like our government allows the drug companies to do. So these state initiatives are so important because, you know, if the federal government isn't going to do it, then there are other ways for us to go. So there's something optimistic here.
I wanted to mention, our governor does things like respond to SBC, which is a San Antonio company. We've had sort of a Texas takeover here, particularly in this particular area. Dynegy owns the Illinois Power, though. They're trying to pass it off to Commonwealth Ed, so I guess the thieves will be in Chicago instead of Houston if that goes ahead. But SBC, I mean, they just did backflips to get SBC, the kind of legislation it wanted recently, and they've cut the brother of the mayor in to be, CEO or something of the company, too. So they're spreading it around a little bit. But, it's just despicable, and it really does hit us where we live. Texas Panhandle is the name of the pipeline company that I think Dynegy has some shares in that's going to gouge the heck out of us this winter with natural gas prices. But actually what I wanted, you flashed on the screen, I think it was actually a TV show on the occasion of Rush Limbaugh's embarrassment, looking at talk radio and why the right and the left are doing differentially. And it flashed you on the screen, but didn't mention that, you know, you were doing quite well. It was basically your rather public argument with the mouse that took you off the air. And that's really
right.
Sort of the pattern. I'd like for you to tell that story because this, whatever media did this, I can't actually recall. Those are the kind of things you need to jot down, I guess. But some show, it might even have been Now, but they just didn't point out that, with Moyers, that they didn't point out that you were taken off when you had quite a healthy listenership and were expanding, and
right.
It just isn't. And it was a corporate decision, basically.
Yeah.
So
yes,
I'd like you to fulminate on that a little bit, and thanks for all your work. And
well, even more significant than getting moused when Disney took over ABC, I had a weekend show, radio show on ABC that, as the caller indicates, was doing quite well. Disney had no interest in a national show that was talking not just about liberal social issues, but was taking on the populist viewpoint of dealing with money and power. So I was very short-lived there. But even more important is today, just what you saw in that show. The New York Times has also done this. There have been various media, established media outlets that are pointing to me as an example of how you can't make it in radio if you are a progressive. When, in fact, none of those outlets have ever even called me, you know, which is, I don't know if they don't have the 512 area code on their phone or quite what it is, but we've received no calls, only that these things appear in print or in broadcast, that somehow or other I'm a failure, and an example of why nobody should even try to do progressive media, which is, you know, absurd, since WILL is doing that right now. But also, I could point out to them not only what happened in that case, but that within a year I was back on the air with a daily talk show, a 2-hour-a-day talk show that ran for 4 years until I decided to withdraw from it because I wanted to do more traveling than that show allowed, or that I've been on the air with my radio commentaries for now 11 years and going very strong, more than 130 stations around the country carry that. But they're wanting to use any excuse as a damper to basically try to get the progressives themselves to self-censor themselves. In fact, not only can we make it on radio, but we are making it, and making it in a lot of other ways as well. You'll notice the New York Times bestseller list these days has my book and Molly Ivan's book and Michael Moore's book, Joel Connison's book, Paul Krugman's book, you know, right on down the line. Very, very progressive voices right at the top of the list.
Our lines remain full. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Eureka on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your commentaries. I listen to them primarily on Radio for Peace International. I've appreciated your comments this morning. My question would be, you've mentioned voting, and I guess a few minutes ago you were getting at it about creating a new democracy. What specific recommendations do you have, sir, as far as how ordinary citizens can keep things moving and keep things rolling?
Right. Well, first of all, just take action where you're most comfortable. First of all, you've got to recognize that you're the one, that there's no leader going to come along and do it. We have to create the possibility of a national leader down the road, but as I said earlier, you don't start with national leaders. The American Revolution didn't start with national leaders. The suffragists and abolitionists, the populists, the labor movement, civil rights movement, women, et cetera, environmental, it's all started at the grassroots level. And the good news is, and this is in my Thieves in High Places, my current book, I think one reason it's doing so well is that I tell these very positive stories of how people are actually doing it already, fighting for living wage, taking on public financing of our elections, and passing these things, battling against sweatshop labor, taking on the Walmarts and the other big box bullies that barge into our neighborhoods and communities. And more often than not, we're winning these fights. And so that, recognize that not only can we do it, but people are doing it right there in wherever you are. There's somebody or some group of somebody's lighting a little prairie fire of rebellion. So first just get connected with those folks. And sometimes these are issue campaigns like living wages and et cetera. Other times they then slide on over into electoral campaigns, because out of these movements come candidates and come campaign managers and people with skills, and you can put it together locally, and then, as I say, you begin to move up. We've got to develop that pool of talent, both in terms of candidates and organizing skills at the grassroots level, and recognize that it's not going to happen in the next presidential election. America's not going to suddenly turn over, but that it's a long-term strategy that we're involved in, a building process, and we're already well along the road to that. We don't have to create the progressive movement. We just got to connect it up.
Can you get your newsletter through your websites?
Yes, you can, jimhightower.com.
Okay.
We'll link you. In fact, you can subscribe online and get it right there, as well as the books and my travel schedule and et cetera.
Okay, and may I ask one final question, please?
Go ahead.
Do you think that voting for third-party candidates can be very useful?
I think it particularly can at a local level, where third-party candidates actually are running and winning, and that's Greens, the Working Family Party, Libertarian Party, and showing that government can actually be different, and particularly in states like Oregon and Minnesota, Wisconsin, California, New Mexico, there are quite a few, even Alaska, there are quite a few victories taking place, and again, building up from the ground level. If the Democrats won't stand forward for the people, somebody's going to. Mm-hmm. I personally am an insurgent Democrat. I want to bring my party home, but I understand the viewpoint of others who say, I'm going to fight from the outside.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We have less than 10 minutes left, and several callers. I want to just ask you to, if you want, talk about the Rolling Thunder Democracy Tour here for a minute, because it's something, seems like something that is involving sort of town hall style gatherings of people rather than some televised event or debate, an attempt to sort of build a grassroots sort of action constituency.
Well, it's based, Jack, on something I mentioned earlier, which is we don't have to create a progressive movement. It's already out there. But the whole of our progressive effort is not greater than the sum of its separate parts right now, because folks aren't connected. People who once out of town dealing with a living wage don't know folks on the outside of town who are fighting against a hog factory, and they don't know the folks who are battling against a toxic waste dump in the inner city. So our need is to link together. And one way to do that is in a festival setting. Give people an excuse to come together from across all the lines of race and political parties and neighborhood that the powers that be draw for us. And so we've created this Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour concept, where local people, local groups get together, decide they want to do it, and are willing to forge a coalition. So beginning from the very start, the coalition building process, and get 30, 40, 50, 70 groups together to put on one of these festivals. And they're usually in parks or at fairgrounds or something like that, community colleges. So think of it like a county fair of democracy. So there's a speech going on over here. Here's some music over there. We got clowns. Patch Adams is a part of that. Ben and Jerry of the ice cream fame. They're involved with us with all kinds of games that they have. We've got food being served from different kinds of restaurants in the community. Usually we have a beer garden so we can lubricate the movement a little bit. We have all kinds of workshops taking place of how you do take power back over every aspect of your lives. We got an action tent, so there are 12 things you can do right there on the day of the event. The event runs usually from noon to 10 o'clock at night or something like that, so there's a whole lot taking place there, and it's fun, and that's our whole concept, too. Our slogan is, let's put the party back in politics. Why should politics be boring committee meetings and something you only do at the last 30 days of an election, rather than make it a part of our social lives?
Very good. We have several calls waiting. Let's go on and include as many as we possibly can. If we're out of time, we'll go next to someone in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, Senator Dick Durbin did a great job shutting down Orrin Hatch in Judiciary Committee hearing last October 22nd. You should look into it. It was highlighted in by Bill Moyer's Now program last
great.
Friday.
Okay, terrific.
He did a great job, and Orrin Hatch was,
Okay, we'll check it out. And by the way, mentioning Now, they're going to do Bill Moyer's Now program is in the next within the next month. I'm not sure of the exact date. Going to do a feature on our Rolling Thunder tour, so that'll be enjoyable, I think.
Yeah, and I've read letters to the editor generated by your Rolling Thunder things that were said at Rolling Thunder that are really wonderful. But I have a quick question and two quick questions. One is, yesterday I was listening to a panel about electronic voting, and a lady called Connie McCormick was defending, the use of electronic voting, and she has a history in Texas. I was curious if you knew her name.
No, I don't know her at all. And by the way, I am not opposed to electronic voting. I'm opposed to it being done without any paper trail. So when we do recounts and fraud charges come up, we can actually find out whether the machine was working or not.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that. And especially if there's any kind of hope for like proportional representation, electronic voting would really help. But but it's got to be done right.
Exactly.
And it's very likely it wouldn't be with these people involved. But then my last question, I understand, and this is one of the things that the left doesn't do well, but finally someone's come across and it happens to be you. In your book, apparently you have a 6-page list of anti-environmental crimes.
Yeah. Well, this is this is just to show the enormity of and the extremism of what is taking place in Washington by the Bushites, again, too often with the complicity of congressional Democrats. So I use the example of just the first 2 years of the Bush administration in just the field of the environment, the changes that they have either made or attempted to make, and it's about six pages, tiny type, dot by dot by dot. It's astonishing to see it.
Yeah, I heard this reviewer mentions a few, like rejected the Kyoto global warming treating, withdrew arsenic in drinking water standards, sought to roll back the roadless national forest plan, tried to shrink boundaries of 19 national monuments.
Yeah, there's no end
to the list. Yeah, and cut 270 positions from the EPA's enforcement division. And this guy just says after he read that, he really felt like heading for the nearest Green Party. And maybe this last parting shot, if you could talk a little bit about Walmart and apparently you do a great job of showing what they're about in your book, and I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I have a chapter on the Beast of Bentonville, as it's known by its own employees, now the largest corporation in the world and the biggest suppressor of wages and middle-class possibilities here and elsewhere around the world. And while I do go into detail about why Walmart is a beast of a corporation, I also tell the good news there, which is that the people are in rebellion against it. Another little reported story, in fact, I have a list, a two-page list of 170 cities in America, the towns and cities that have defeated Walmart or the other big box bullies. And I also list connections for those of you who want to take on the beast yourself.
Okay, well, we have just about 2 minutes left. We'll get to at least one more caller here. There's someone on line number two, I believe, on a cell phone. Good morning. Hello?
Good morning. I hope you can hear me okay. Just a quick word on the debate about whether to participate with progressive parties such as the Green Party or to stay in the mainstream party. One of the most eloquent statements on that issue that I ever heard was last February at our local Urbana City Council meeting when folks brought a petition before the city council to oppose the Iraq war. And one of the young councilmen who was a Democrat spoke up finally and said, you know, many of you are my friends. We debated last fall when the presidential election was being held in 2000 whether or not the Green Party should throw their weight behind Al Gore to assure that Bush doesn't get elected. Well, the Green Party didn't do that, and Bush did get elected. At the time, the Green Party said, things will have to get worse. If a Republican gets elected, so be it. But the only way to affect change is to allow things to get a little worse. And he said, now things are worse. We're going to have a war, and people from poor communities are going to get killed because that is where they happen to find their job opportunity in the armed forces. You are the reason we're having this war. Rather shocking tones from a Democrat to a contingent of the activists that were there, mostly from the Green Party. How do you respond to that?
Things are as worse as we need them to get, that's for sure, right now. And rather than get into a mud fight over what happened last time, I think it's important to focus on what we can do this time. And what I find as I roam around the country is people are ready to get together. Some are supporting third-party candidates. Some are supporting various of the nine Democratic possibilities right now. But the important thing is not be mad at each other, because once that, about next April, we're all going to need to get together and go after George W., because I think he's a one-term president if we just, get focused and get in motion. In fact, I know people who are at their voting booth right now, Jack, and are not going to move until next November when they get a chance to vote this guy out. So I think progressives have got their heads screwed on, got our eye on the prize, but let's remember that defeating Bush is not a progressive victory. We certainly have to do that. But having done it, then we've got to redouble our grassroots effort to build a true progressive movement.
We're going to have to leave it there since we're out of time. The book is Thieves in High Places. The author, our guest, Jim Hightower. You can also look at his website, jimhightower.com, or for the Hightower Lowdown newsletter, jimhightowerlowdown.org. And to you, Jim Hightower, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.